What do we do about the fact that things seldom work perfectly? There is an expression that someone coined that I'm fond of. The expression is called the spirituality of imperfection. And it comes to me through, I think mostly through recovery, through AA. I believe it's an expression that's used in some circles of AA, the spirituality of imperfection. And some spirituality that somehow acknowledges and begins with a recognition of our imperfection. And rather than beginning with some chasing after perfection or assumption of perfection. And it's a very humane form of spirituality because it begins where we're at. Because there's a fair percentage of us who are here this morning who have some imperfections. I won't give you what percentage of you are. And if it's not imperfect, we're imperfect in all kinds of ways. There's ways that we're human beings, we could say, are inherently imperfect in that we have limitations. There's sickness, old age, and death. So many of us have some kind of physical limitation or some kind of maybe mental limitation on who we are. We have some kind of emotional or psychological limitation that maybe we're born this way or somehow it evolved over time. And sooner or later, all human beings are going to encounter their limitations because that's, you know, you're going to die. It gets old, sick. And then, so there's the imperfections of limitations. And there's also the, which are inherent in who we are, and there's also the psychological hang-ups we have that often are quite embarrassing to have, or we're upset to have, or reacting to having it. So the spirituality of imperfection begins with acknowledging, seeing what could be called our imperfections. And the reason, so, and it's not unique to, far from unique that Buddhism would emphasize this. As you said, some of this comes from AA, but I think most good spiritualities has some way of acknowledging our imperfections in a way that helps to settle us, that helps us come to peace. And for people who are involved in meditation practice or any kind of wise spiritual practice, but especially meditation practice, we need to come to some kind of relationship to what we could for now call our imperfections, so that those imperfections or our relationship to those imperfections doesn't keep us agitated, doesn't keep us spinning out and caught up in our concerns. Can we have some relationship to our imperfection so it helps us to settle down? And meditation practice is, among other things, a settling practice, a settling out, settling down, letting some kind of agitation, spinning, movement of the mind settle down. And so how can we relate to our imperfections in order to settle down? One of the ways not to do that is by trying to run away from our limitations, our imperfections, our agitations, our fears, our worries, you know, to run away from it. And it's so easy to run away. We run away in our thoughts. We start thinking and problem solving or thinking about something else. And we spin away so quickly from what's, you know, really important in operating here. So, I mean, this is a very simple example, but I don't know how many of you noticed, but 9:45, someone came in here to make an announcement about moving a car out in the parking lot so that the bloodmobile truck could get in here. And she came up here and wanted me to make an announcement in the middle of the sitting. So then there was this kind of tension between, well, disturbing all of you, or disturbing the good people who brought the bloodmobile truck, right? Where's the solution? And so decided not to say anything. But after it left, I could feel that I was kind of a little bit agitated, energized in more way. You know, I've been sitting very quietly, and this concern had energized my mind. And it took me a minute or so to realize that my mind now, being energized, was now spinning out, thinking about the solutions to this parking problem. And I was spinning out away from myself. And here I was meditating, I was supposed to be settling myself. So what I did was I turned around and then brought my attention, my presence, right smack in the middle of where that energized feeling was in my being. And really acknowledge, this is what's going on. I'm energized, I'm concerned, I'm problem solving. Really acknowledge that very clearly. And in doing that, it's kind of like going in and then allowing me to settle down into that experience. I wasn't pushing it away, I wasn't trying to fix it, the problem out there. But I was bringing myself very clearly to realize, oh, this is how I'm agitated right now. Let's feel that, let's be present for it. And in that, allowing me to settle. So part of the reason to talk about the spirituality of imperfection is that we need to find some way, I think, to relate to what agitates us, what keeps us kind of fragmented from ourselves or in pain or in some way, that keeps us from settling. So the spirituality of imperfection is one that willingly looks at our imperfection, sees it, understands it, and in some way or other accepts it. To see, to understand, and to accept. And so one way we spin out is by thinking about a lot of it. Another way is to run away. We try to run away from it. Or we try to blame it or attack it. Or we try to deny it. Or we try to fix it. Or there's all kinds of ways in which we don't get settled around something, but we're kind of in a reactive relationship to it. Ajahn Chah, a Thai teacher, said, if you run away from your suffering, it'll chase you. So one approach to our limitations, our imperfections, things that bother us, is to turn into it, turn towards it. And to turn towards it, not to attack it, but to turn towards it to find, can you sit in the middle of it and allow it to be? To enter into it. Just like I did with this energized state. Just this. I'll sit there with that. And so and I believe, and my impression is that one of the definitions of a spiritually mature person, at least I'll limit it to Buddhism at least, I shouldn't speak about other people's spirituality, is one of the aspects of maturity is to be very accepting of one's own limitations, one's own condition, unapologetically, undefensively. And I've seen a lot of people now who have practiced for years and years. I know people, teachers, who people have been practicing for 30, 40 years, who are friends of mine now, and a variety of different people. And I still find it really refreshing when they'll talk about some foible, some difficulty they have. And they'll do it completely transparently, completely unapologetically. They're not trying to make themselves look better in anybody's eyes. They're not trying to present some good front in who they are. And they're just very relaxed at ease about, I'm still dealing with the fact, I'm still dealing with the fact that I get angry. Can you believe it? I can't believe, I still have to deal with this fear, that's the way it is for me. And they just say it, and there's something very refreshing to me to hear it, because I don't feel like they're troubled by it or oppressed by it or somehow, dare I say the word, limited by it. It's just what is. This is what their condition is, and they're dealing with it best they can, but they're not making it a problem more than it is. So not making it a problem more than it is. Now, if we come back to meditation practice as a reference point, we're meditating here, it's very helpful not to make anything a problem. Because when you make it a problem, you tend to agitate the mind. And you're going the mind opposite direction than we're trying to do in meditation, which is settle the mind. So in meditation in particular, it's a very useful place to enter into what is actually happening now. What is happening here for you? And if it's some kind of limitation or imperfection, which is the operating big thing, what is it to enter into that and then find yourself in meditation to settle through that, as opposed to trying to bypass it? Oh, I think I'm going to get concentrated in my breath, so I want it to feel so sad or so upset. You could do that sometimes, bypass it. But what about just coming into the upsetness and feeling it and taking a good posture, composing yourself on it, and then seeing, can you work the edges of it so that all the ways in which you're reacting to the upsetness can first fall away? So you get permission for the upsetness just to be there. I'm upset, that's what's happening. Okay, I don't like being upset, I'm embarrassed by being upset. Let me at least settle those kind of peripheral things. And can it possible just to be upset? And then sit in the middle of it. So that helps a settling process. So there was a poem that I referred to last week that tonight, this morning, I'll read. One of my imperfections now is putting my glasses on the edge of my nose so I can read. I have these progressive lenses I have been wearing, but I don't like them so much, so I got my old glasses out, so now I guess they're good. And then I can read. One dervish, this is Rumi. One dervish to another. What was your vision of God's presence? I haven't seen anything, but for the sake of conversation, I'll tell you a story. God's presence is there in front of me, a fire on the left, a lovely stream on the right. One group walks toward the fire, into the fire, another toward the sweet flowing water. No one knows which are blessed and which not. Whoever walks into the fire appears suddenly in the stream. A head goes under on the water surface. That head pokes out of the fire. Most people guard against going into the fire and so end up in it. Those who love the water of pleasure and make it their devotion are cheated by this reversal. The trickery goes further. The voice of the fire tells the truth, saying, I am not fire. I am fountainhead. Come into me and don't mind the sparks. If you are a friend of God, fire is your water. You should wish to have 100,000 sets of moth wings so you can burn them away one set a night. The moth sees light and goes into fire. You should see fire and go toward light. Fire is what of God is world consuming, water world protecting. Somehow each gives the appearance of the other. To these eyes you have now, what looks like water burns. What looks like fire is a great relief to be inside. One molecule mote second thinking of God's reversal of comfort and pain is better than any attending ritual. That splinter of intelligence is substance, the fire and water themselves, accidental, done with mirrors. So that's quite an impressive imagery. Go into the fire, into that which is going to burn you. Go into that which you're afraid of, that where the suffering is, the pain is. Can you go into it? And I think a lot of Buddhist spirituality involves this willingness to acknowledge the suffering, the fire, the imperfection, and then in a certain wise way, learning to go into it. And there, find the relief, the release. There, find the peace. So this is from Rumi, and just to get a sense that, you know, it has a kind of a wider currency in the world than just in Sufism. Socrates said, pain and pleasure are never present to a person at the same instant. And yet, the person who pursues either is compelled to take the other. Pursue pleasure and you end up with pain. Pursue pain, you end up with pleasure. I don't know if we want to make that into a solid rule, So it's kind of an interesting thing that here Socrates also says the same thing. Or Carl Jung says, one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. So again, where the darkness, that which you don't want to look at, that which you're trying to avoid, that to make it conscious. So how to do it in a way that is enlightening, how to do it in a way that's settling, that brings peace. That's really the art that we're trying to find here. And so each of you has your suffering. And what is it like to turn into it, and in doing that, find peace, rather than be re-traumatized, rather than being agitated even more troubled by it. This is another Rumi poem. It's very famous, so some of you know it. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and respect them all. Even if they're a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture, still treat each guest honorably. He or she may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whoever comes, because each has been sent as a guide. The part of the willingness to see, understand, and accept our imperfections is that it has an effect on us, which I think is often quite helpful. One effect is that it can be humbling, creates a kind of healthy humility. And I think that that's always good. Classically, Buddhism is not so much about imperfection, it's more about perfection. Buddhism is, in its heart, a kind of a spirituality of perfection, unfortunately. Because what we're asked to do, with the path of Buddhism, is pointing to a possibility of complete peace, perfect peace. So it's not simply accept your imperfection, accept your suffering, and then just suffer, you know, just go through life suffering, you know, happily. It isn't that kind of acceptance we're talking about. But we're talking about learning to turn into where there's suffering, learn where there's imperfection, so that we can settle it and move beyond it into some other new level of peace. And that's the pointing towards the areas of perfection for Buddhism. The perfect person in Buddhism is someone who's been able to move beyond their peace, or settled it. Not beyond, not the right word, but settled it, to resolve it, so it's no longer there. But however, because Buddhism has this kind of emphasis on perfection, it's not a few Buddhists who end up being arrogant. Look at me. You know, I have reached, you know, a certain stage of attainment. You know, I've managed to get into the fifth jhana, you know, and it's so great, my concentration level. And I've known people who kind of have a chip on their shoulder about their attainment and where they're at. And it's a kind of an irritation for everybody else. And but then more importantly, it's a kind of a way in which we don't really meet people in a healthy way, healing way, heartfelt way, if we have that kind of arrogance. Humility, I think, more often than not, has the effect of allowing us to meet more as humans, meet more completely as who we actually are. We don't see ourselves as being so separate and different and it's better than everybody else. We're all in the boat together. Everybody's struggling. I think most people struggle. Everyone struggles some way or other. And to recognize that. And in doing that, perhaps also becoming more tolerant of each other. Infinitely tolerant of other people's struggles and difficulties and imperfections. a story I like to tell. I'm sorry, I have to repeat myself. Is in 1982 I was ordained as a Zen priest, Zen monk, and I was kind of I didn't relate to rituals much, and rituals had no meaning for me. But it was a ritual you go through to get ordained, and I was struck at the impact that ritual and ordination had on me that I hadn't expected. And one impact was that it made me much more aware of my shortcomings. And partly because now my head was shaved, I was a public figure, people looked at me a certain way, and I kind of represented practice, and so, you know, I had something to live up to, in a sense. So I became much more, because of that, I became much more acutely aware of my imperfections, or my shortcomings, I called them then. And at the same time, it was more okay to have them. Somehow the image, the language I used for myself back then was that I was now a child of the Buddha. So I was kind of accepted by the Buddha, in a sense. And so I was more aware of my shortcomings, and it was more okay to have them. And that combination, I thought it was lovely. Really great. And it was okay to have them so I can just kind of merely go along with, you know, bulldozing over people, whatever my imperfections were. But then I had to work with them. I had to kind of enter into their world and try to settle them and resolve and deal with them. But I wasn't troubled by the fact that I had them. Not being troubled by our problems. Isn't that great? This is who I am. I'm someone who gets angry. So, I'm working on it. Cheer me on. That's just how it is, you know? Back then it was the case. You know, back then I was dealing with anger. And so this kind of spirituality of perfection requires being very honest about ourselves. This is what is going on for me. This is what I'm struggling with. This is what's happening for me. And now that I see that, can I understand it in a wise way? Can I understand it with compassion, with care? Can I understand that it's part of the human condition, that everyone has limitations of some kind or other, and this is what I have. For whatever reason, this is what I have. And then, can I accept it? So that I'm not fighting it or struggling with it, making it more of a problem than it is. Can I accept it? And for meditators, as I said before, this is very important, because what we're trying to do is to settle, to come to some kind of peace. In meditation, you don't want to kind of be spinning out in your mind, thinking all the time, thinking and thinking and trying to fix and analyze it, and go back over rehearse the past over and over again and try to figure out why is this happening and what's a better rejoinder in the future and, you know, try to think and think and think and think. Because that thinking world, going out and out and out, doesn't help us to settle. Actually, meditation is the opposite direction. Rather than spinning out into thought, we want to, to some degree, settle our thinking. Put it all aside, all the attempts to fix and improve the world. And turn the attention, the energy of attention, inwards, so that all this can settle down. Like the like the waves of the ocean. If you are a pond, if you're sitting there kind of at the edge of the pond with your feet in the pond, kicking the water's never going to settle. You have to stop kicking, and then the water can settle down, become clear and translucent, transparent. So there has to be some understanding in this in meditation circles how important it is not to be caught up in the world of thinking. But to kind of turn the attention in the other direction. So one of the ways that it requires, though, in the spirituality of imperfection, is to recognize I am thinking a lot. That's what's going on. My mind's out of control, if that's the case. And then learn how to enter that in a meditative way, to acknowledge it. Oh, thinking is happening. Here's a person who's agitated. This is what's happening now. Here's a person who's consumed with thinking about the future. This is what it's like. This is what it feels like. This is what it feels like in the forehead, in the temples. This is what it feels like in the jaws and the shoulders. This is what it feels like in the brain. These are the emotions that are in the present moment or seem to be fueling this kind of thinking. Come back. Always come back here. Come back here. Come back here. What is here? And then can you be with what's here without making it a problem? Spirituality of imperfection is trying to stop seeing things as problems so we can settle. This is written by a nun, a Japanese Buddhist nun from the 10th century, Izumi Shikibu. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. Whenever a Japanese Zen monk or nun writes about the moonlight or the moon, you know it's symbolic. This house, this ruined house, is herself. Although the wind blows terribly here, the moonlight also leaks between the roof planks of this ruined house. So what are the winds that blow through your ruined house, the cracks of your life? It's painful. I don't want to deny that it's painful. Part of the reason we avoid it, because it's painful. But in the very pain, in the gaps in the house, also the moonlight. The moonlight is symbolic of enlightenment in this kind of poetry. Also shines through. So I'll end the talk with a challenge to all of you. And the challenge is, what area of your life could you more fully accept and become transparent about? What area of your life could you just kind of even, this is who I am. Acknowledge it, see it, accept it. And in accepting it, find some deeper degree of peace. Find a path to peace in that acceptance. That's your challenge. So we have a little bit of time if anyone has any questions or comments they'd like to make.
This came up for me because I feel like whenever I hear these Rumi poems, they're sort of like it seems like everything in the world is a sign.
Is a sign?
Yeah, and I feel like I've met people who because they see everything in the world as a sign, like it's kind of they tend to overdo it, or like I guess I felt like a little skepticism. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how directly this relates to your talk, although I think when you're working on your imperfections, a lot of times like you have that issue, you're like, is this a sign or is it not a sign, or is it just like a piece of paper blowing down the street or something like that, you know?
Yeah, it's a hard, I don't know the answer to that question. I mean, people often have a sense of there's all these lessons and that come from things happening, and all this serendipity that happens that teaches us something. And sometimes, I've noticed that if I have some kind of issue that's going on, my antennas are up in a certain way, and so I'm more likely to pick up something that seems relevant than I would before, or make it relevant. You know, it's like a dream, right? The dream can be interpreted different ways, perhaps, but we interpret in a way that's useful for us. So, I have certain, my antenna's up a certain way and has a concern, and I'm looking for some understanding, and that helps me. I don't know if that was originally intended. So the signs partly are interpretive, right? So sometimes the inner psyche, the so-called unconscious perhaps, has a certain kind of wisdom that our conscious mind doesn't have. And so the way in which we interpret things in the world might be coming partly out of this unconscious that seems to know. But it's I think that more to the point of my talk, every reaction we have is a sign, is a lesson. And the question is, are you willing to use that lesson? So I don't know about the paper blowing in the wind out there, but if you have a reaction to the paper, then that reaction is a sign that there's a lesson there for you. Does the paper by itself, I don't know. Is that helpful at all, my comments? To the point? Yes?
In Rumi's tradition, they talk a lot about ecstasy and the ecstasy of union. How does that we're talking a lot about suffering, but how does the idea of ecstasy fit in with Buddhist thinking?
The word ecstasy is seldom used in English in American Buddhist circles. What's the Greek etymology of ecstasy mean? Someone know?
Outside
oneself. So, you know, that's kind of not, it doesn't work so well for Buddhism. words like bliss,
yes,
rapture,
yes,
happiness are all words that are very important in Buddhism. And the path to liberation goes through joy. It has to be part of it. And it's a very important part of it. So it's expected part of the path. And so the emphasis on suffering is not so we can just suffer better. But rather it's to do what Rumi is saying. You go into it so you can settle it, you can resolve it, you can release it. And that path of releasing it is one of joy. Now, this thing about turning into something in meditation, what's going on, and not thinking about it more and more and more, is that if we can get settled in meditation, in the present moment, just be content and happy with the present moment, and put aside the problems which are in the past or in the future, outside of this particular time and place, and just be here for this experience, that can provide a person with a degree of well-being and peace that gives them a very different perspective for understanding the problems out there. And so sometimes it's very useful to do to really have the ability to settle something really deep, so we can experience, look at it from a different level. And one of that deeper levels is the experience of well-being. It could be joy and something like that. So does this address your question enough, or is it you have a more particular issue of union was you brought up also? Is that important for you, or just the ecstasy part?
I meant more like bliss or joy rather than in Sufi terms. Sometimes they talk about ecstasy of union. Yes, you answered the question.
Yeah. And the it's not uncommon for some people who meditate, especially people who meditate a lot and really get into that, make it a real strong habit of it, so momentum gets built over time, to report that the degree of joy or rapture or happiness they feel in meditation surpasses anything they feel outside of meditation. That's possible there. The difference between in Buddhist spirituality, it's very important not to take rapture or bliss or happiness as the end point. It's steps along the path. It's not the point. Yes.
Is it ever inadvisable to walk right into the fire? I mean, is it ever advisable to use a strategy that you know is a strategy and may not be exactly sitting with
mm-hmm. it? Yes. Yes, if you have flammable clothes, then don't go into the fire. And so some of us carry with us issues and ways of being that will just make the fire stronger if we go into it. Some people get re-traumatized, for example, if they go into their trauma or into their pain. And so hopefully the practice of mindfulness will be self-correcting. If you try to be present for your suffering and you realize that actually you're suffering more, it's actually getting more difficult and doesn't seem wise, then hopefully you do a course correction and realize that this is not a useful approach for me and I need another approach in order to deal with this. And so for example, one approach is some people, rather than going into their self-loathing and self-despair, self-criticism, find it more useful maybe sometimes to do loving-kindness practice for a while, to do the antidote, and really settle some, kind of create a different attitude, different understanding of how they relate to themselves. And then they can open to that later. So there are definitely times. It's very important. It's very important to be unapologetic, transparent, very accepting, that I can't do what Gil said today. You know, Gil, I hear the talk today was turned into, right? Go into the fire. And but sometimes the limitation is I can't do that. This is not useful. I need to do something else. And that's really wise. It's not an inferior thing to do. It can be very, very wise to know this is my limitation. This is my situation. And I need, in order to take care of this, I have to do something. This is what I have to do. Is that it?
So is the idea behind walking into the fire and being a little moth and keep burning your wings, is that ultimately that the idea is that all that suffering, all that that you're dealing with gets burned off and eventually it's gone? Or is it that you just become accepting of the fact that it's there?
I think in Buddhism, the aim is to actually free yourself from suffering. Not just to be accepting of suffering, you know, not become a world-class acceptor. But the path to that, one path, there's different paths, but one path I'm offering today, which I think is very helpful on many fronts, is you start by accepting your situation. That's the entry. Because if you're reacting and running away, you're not going to be able to settle there, or work with it, or resolve it. So the first step is to see it, to understand it if you can, and accept it. But don't leave it. Don't leave it just an acceptance. But then go further. Now some things are accepted, so they no longer become a hindrance to the mind, no longer a concern of the mind. Then the mind can settle into a deeper place, and then eventually deal with the roots of the very problem itself. So, for example, if someone's suffering has to do with it was a joke I thought about earlier. I was going to say earlier, but I censored myself. There was a executive in a, say, in one of these big Silicon Valley corporations, who was a great executive, helped the company a lot, but he had one problem, and then when he got up in front of very important meetings to make big presentations, like to the board and stuff like that, he would pee in his pants. And so So the CEO of the company came up to him and said, "You got to do something about this problem." And so you're really big, you're important in our company, and so we're going to send you to the psychologist. So he goes to the therapist for a while, and after a while he comes back, and the CEO says, "Are you cured?" And he said, he comes back and says, "Oh, I'm cured." And the CEO says, "Oh, you mean you don't pee in your pants anymore?" And he said, "No, I'm no longer embarrassed." So maybe there's foolish kind of acceptance too. Sometimes you have to deal with your problems, but So I don't know where I'm at. I'm sorry. So the point is not just to be accepting and suffer more. The point is to be accepting so that the way we are with our issues is not adding more trouble to it, not adding more fire, not adding less clarity, but rather to find out how to be at peace or accepting or at ease with our difficulties, how to turn into them and not get agitated because of it, so we can see them more clearly, with more depth, so we can settle them, so we can go into meditation and put those aside in a sense, not by pushing them aside, by kind of settling into them and through them into some deeper place. And that deeper, having that deeper perspective then shows us a very different relationship to our problems. I think almost anybody who meditates to some degree probably has the experience of being caught up in some kind of concern, something really important, all those things to do and all this, and then meditating and then coming out of meditation and say, what was the problem? Why was I so caught up in all these things I had to do and running around my problems? And suddenly the mind, meditation creates much more peace or space in the mind. So the way we kind of get wrapped up around our thoughts gets unwound a little bit. Maybe this can be the last one.
While you were talking, an image arose for me, which it kind of clicked for me in understanding. It's sort of like... if I were to imagine that I'm this like column of gold, and what if all of these impurities, you know, when we go to purify gold, we usually put it through fire, and all these impurities get dissolved and transformed and pushed off. It's sort of like identifying with the gold, kind of coming into the gold, and then all those thoughts sort of burn up, if you will. They just kind of... go away.
And you rest in
this place where
you're not,
you're fully aware of what happened, but you're not taken aback by it. You know, you just know this is the process. So anyway, that just sort of made sense to me.
Beautiful. Yeah, the Buddha had a similar analogy with gold for a mind that's well concentrated. So. This idea of the spirituality of imperfection, one of the reasons I like it is that, in my mind at least, it's a approach to spiritual life which is well integrated, because it doesn't leave anything out. It kind of allows us to kind of connect to who we are really and accept who we are, rather than saying, oh, this shouldn't be part of the path, I shouldn't be dealing with this. But rather, everything gets included in this way. And I think it's much safer to engage in Buddhist practice if it's integrated. So thank you, everyone, and also a special thanks to those people who are here today in order to offer their blood to people who need blood. So that was wonderful that people set that up, and thank you for doing that.